Chapter 21. Ada was denied the free use of the library. According to the latest list, printed May 1, 1884, it contained 14,841 items, and even that dry catalogue her governess preferred not to place in the child's hands, pour ne pas lui donner des idées. On her own shelves, to be sure, Ada had taxonomic works on botany and entomology, as well as her school books and a few innocuous popular novels. But not only was she not supposed to browse in the library unsupervised, but every book she took out to read in bed or bower had to be checked by her mentor and charged en lecture, with name and stamped date in the index card files kept in a careful mess by Mademoiselle La Riviere, and in a kind of desperate order, with the insertion of queries, calls of distress, and even imprecations on bits of pink, red, or purple paper, by a cousin of hers, Monsieur Philippe Vergère, a diminutive old bachelor, morbidly silent and shy, who moused in every other week for a few hours of quiet work. So quiet, in fact, that one afternoon when a tallish library ladder suddenly went into an eerie, backward, slow-motion swoon with him high up on it, embracing a windmill of volumes, he reached the floor supine, with his ladder and books, in such a hush that guilty Ada, who had thought she was alone, pulling out and scanning the utterly unrewarding Arabian Nights, mistook his fall for the shadow of a door being stealthily opened by some soft-fleshed eunuch. Her intimacy with her chère, trop chère Renée, as she sometimes called Vaughn in gentle jest, changed the reading situation entirely, whatever degrees still remained pinned up in mid-air. Soon upon his arrival at Ardis, Vaughn warned his former governess, who had reasons to believe in his threats, that if he were not permitted to remove from the library at any time for any length of time and without any trace of en lecture, any volume, collected works, boxed pamphlets or incunabulum that he might fancy, he would have Miss Vertigrad, his father's librarian, a completely servile and infinitely accommodative spinster of Vergère's format and presumable date of publication, post to Ardis Hall, trunkfuls of 18th-century libertines, German sexologists, and a whole circus of Shastras and Nefsawis in literal translation with apocryphal addenda. Puzzled Mademoiselle La Riviere would have consulted the master of Ardis, but she never discussed with him anything serious since the day, in January 1876, when he had made an unexpected, and rather half-heartedly, really, let us be fair, pass at her. As to dear frivolous Marina, she only remarked, when consulted, that at Vaughn's age she would have poisoned her governess with anti-roach borax if forbidden to read, for example, Turgenev's Smoke. Thereafter, anything Ada wanted or might have wanted to want was placed by Vaughn at her disposal in various safe nooks, and the only visible consequence of Vergère's perplexities and despair was an increase in the scatter of a curious snow-white dust that he always left here and there, on the dark carpet, in this or that spot of plodding occupation, such a cruel curse on such a neat little man. At a nice Christmas party for private librarians arranged under the auspices of the Braille Club in Raduga a couple of years earlier, empathic Miss Vertigrad had noticed that she and giggling Vergère, with whom she was in the act of sharing a quiet little cracker, tugged apart with no audible result, nor did the gold paper frilled at both ends yield any bonbon or breloque or other favor of fate, shared also a spectacular skin disease that had been portrayed recently by a famous American novelist in his Chiron, and described in side-splitting style by a co-sufferer who wrote essays for a London weekly. Very delicately, Miss Vertigrad would transmit through Vaughn library slips to the rather unresponsive Frenchman with this or that concise suggestion, Mercury, or Hohenzollern, works wonders. Mademoiselle, who was in the know too, looked up psoriasis in a one-volume medical encyclopedia, which her late mother had left her, and which had not only helped her and her charges on various minor occasions, but had suggested suitable illnesses for the characters in the stories she contributed to the Quebec Quarterly. In the present case, the cure optimistically advised was to take a warm bath at least twice a month and avoid spices. This she typed out and passed on to her cousin in a get-well envelope. Finally, Ada showed Vaughn a letter from Dr. Krolik on the same subject. It said, English version, "Crimson blotched, silver scaled, yellow crusted wretches, the harmless psoriatics, who cannot communicate their skin trouble and are otherwise the healthiest of people. Actually, their bobos protect them from boobas and bubos, as my teacher used to observe, were confused with lepers. Yes, lepers, in the Middle Ages, when thousands, if not millions, of vergers and vertigrades crackled and howled, bound by enthusiasts to stakes erected in the public squares of Spain and other fire-loving countries. But this note they decided not to plant in the Meek Martyrs Index under P.S., as they had first intended. Lepidopterists are over-eloquent on lepidosis. Novels, poems, scientific and philosophical works wandered out unnoticed after the poor librarian gave his démission éplorée on the 1st of August, 1884. They crossed lawns and traveled along hedges somewhat in the manner of the objects carried away by the invisible man in Wells' delightful tale, and landed in Ada's lap, wherever she and Vaughn had their trysts. Both sought excitement in books, as the best readers always do. Both found in many renowned works pretentiousness, tedium, and facile misinformation. In a story by Chateaubriand about a pair of romantic siblings, Ada had not quite understood when she first read it at 9 or 10 the sentence, "Les deux enfants pouvaient donc s'abandonner au plaisir sans aucune crainte." A bawdy critic in a collection of articles which she now could gleefully consult, Les Muses s'amusent, explained that the donc referred both to the infertility of tender age and to the sterility of tender consanguinity. Vaughn said, however, that the writer and the critic erred, and to illustrate his contention, drew his sweetheart's attention to a chapter in the opus Sex and Lex, dealing with the effects on the community of a disastrous caprice of nature. In those times in this country, incestuous meant not only unchaste, the point regarded linguistics rather than legalistics, but also implied, in the phrase incestuous cohabitation and so forth, interference with the continuity of human evolution. History had long replaced appeals to divine law by common sense and popular science. With those considerations in mind, incest could be termed a crime only inasmuch as inbreeding might be criminal. But as Judge Bald pointed out already during the albino riots of 1835, practically all North American and Tartar agriculturalists and animal farmers used inbreeding as a method of propagation that tended to preserve and stimulate, stabilize, and even create anew favorable characters in a race or strain, unless practiced too rigidly. If practiced rigidly, incest led to various forms of decline, to the production of cripples, weaklings, muted mutates, and finally, to hopeless sterility. Now that smacked of crime. And since nobody could be supposed to control judiciously orgies of indiscriminate inbreeding, somewhere in Tartary, 50 generations of ever woolier and woolier sheep had recently ended abruptly in one hairless, five-legged, impotent little lamb, and the beheading of a number of farmers failed to resurrect the fat strain. It was perhaps better to ban incestuous cohabitation altogether. Judge Bald and his followers disagreed, perceiving in the deliberate suppression of a possible benefit for the sake of avoiding a probable evil, the infringement of one of humanity's main rights, that of enjoying the liberty of its evolution, a liberty no other creature had ever known. Unfortunately, after the rumored misadventure of the Volga herds and herdsmen, a much better documented fait divers happened in the USA at the height of the controversy. An American, a certain Ivan Ivanov of Yukonsk, described as an habitually intoxicated laborer. A good definition, said Ada lightly, of the true artist. Managed somehow to impregnate in his sleep, it was claimed by him and his huge family, his 5-year-old great-granddaughter, Maria Ivanov, and then, 5 years later, also got Maria's daughter, Daria, with child, in another fit of somnolence. Photographs of Maria, a 10-year-old granny with little Daria and baby Varya crawling around her, appeared in all the newspapers, and all kinds of amusing puzzles were provided by the genealogical farce that the relationships between the numerous living and not always clean living members of the Ivanov clan had become in angry Yutkansk. Before the 60-year-old somnambulist could go on procreating, he was clapped into a monastery for 15 years, as required by an ancient Russian law. Upon his release, he proposed to make honorable amends by marrying Daria, now a buxom lass with problems of her own. Journalists made a lot of the wedding, and the shower of gifts from well-wishers, old ladies in New England, a progressive poet in residence at Tennessee Waltz College, an entire Mexican high school, etc. And on the same day, Gamaliel, then a stout young senator, thumped a conference table with such force that he hurt his fist and demanded a retrial and capital punishment. It was, of course, only a temperamental gesture, but the Ivanov affair cast a long shadow upon the little matter of favorable inbreeding. By mid-century, not only first cousins, but uncles and grandnieces were forbidden to intermarry. And in some fertile parts of Estoti, the izba windows of large peasant families in which up to a dozen people of different size and sex slept on one blin-like mattress were ordered to be kept uncurtained at night for the convenience of petrol torch-flashing patrols, peeping pats, as the anti-Irish tabloids called them. Another hearty laugh shook Van when he unearthed for entomologically-minded Ada the following passage in a reliable History of Mating Habits. Some of the perils and ridicule which attend the missionary position adopted for mating purposes by our puritanical intelligentsia, and so justly derided by the primitive but healthy-minded natives of the Biguri Islands, are pointed out by a prominent French orientalist, thick footnote skipped here, who describes the mating habits of the fly, Ceromia amorata, pupar. Copulation takes place with both ventral surfaces pressed together and the mouths touching. When the last throb, frisson, of intercourse is terminated, the female sucks out the male's body content through the mouth of her impassioned partner. One supposes, see Pesson et al., another copious footnote, that the titbits, such as the juicy leg of a bug enveloped in a webby substance, or even a mere token, the frivolous dead end or subtle beginning of an evolutionary process, qui le sait, such as a petal carefully wrapped up and tied up with a frond of red fern, which certain male flies, but apparently not the femorata and amorata morons, bring to the female before mating, represent a prudent guarantee against the misplaced voracity of the young lady. Still more amusing was the message of a Canadian social worker, Madame de Rayon Ficchini, who published her treatise on contraceptive devices in Capuscan Patois, to spare the blushes of Estotians and United Statians, while instructing hardier fellow workers in her special field. Sole sura metoda, she wrote, por decevor natura, est por un strong guy di continuo, 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 jusque le plaisir brims, et lors, a l'ultima instanta, svicera a l'altra groppa, groove. Ma per qua un femme adora endor ponderosa ne se returna quick enough, la transita e facilitata per posito torovago. And that term an appended glossary explained in blunt English as the posture generally adopted in rural communities by all classes, beginning by the country gentry and ending up with the lowliest farm animals throughout the United Americas from Patagonia to Gasp. Ergo, concluded Van, our missionary goes up in smoke. Your vulgarity knows no bounds, said Ada. Well, I prefer to burn than to be slurped up alive by the Sharami, or whatever you call her, and have my widow lay a lot of tiny green eggs on top of it. Paradoxically, Scient Ada was bored by big learned works with woodcuts of organs, pictures of dismal medieval whorehouses, and photographs of this or that little Caesar in the process of being ripped out of the uterus as performed by butchers and masked surgeons in ancient and modern times. Whereas Vaughn, who disliked natural history and fanatically denounced the existence of physical pain in all worlds, was infinitely fascinated by descriptions and depictions of harrowed human flesh. Otherwise, in more flowery fields, their tastes and titters proved to be much the same. They liked Rabelais and Casanova. They loathed Le Sieur Sade and Herr Massach and Heinrich Müller. English and French pornographic poetry, though now and then witty and instructive, sickened them in the long run. And its tendency, especially in France before the invasion, of having monks and nuns perform sexual feats seemed to them as incomprehensible as it was depressing. The collection of Uncle Dan's Oriental erotica prints turned out to be artistically second-rate and inept calisthenically. In the most hilarious and expensive picture, a Mongolian woman with an inane oval face surmounted by a hideous hairdo was shown communicating sexually with six rather plump, blank-faced gymnasts in what looked like a display window jammed with screens, potted plants, silks, paper fans, and crockery. Three of the males, contorted in attitudes of intricate discomfort, were using simultaneously three of the harlot's main orifices. Two older clients were treated by her manually, and the sixth, a dwarf, had to be contented with her deformed foot. Six other voluptuaries were sodomizing her immediate partners, and one more had got stuck in her armpit. Uncle Dan, having patiently disentangled all those limbs and belly folds directly or indirectly connected with the absolutely calm lady, still retaining somehow parts of her robes, had penciled a note that gave the price of the picture and identified it as Geisha with 13 Lovers. Vaughn located, however, a 15th navel thrown in by the generous artist, but impossible to account for anatomically. That library had provided a raised stage for the unforgettable scene of the burning barn. It had thrown open its glazed doors. It had promised a long idyll of bibliolatry. It might have become a chapter in one of the old novels on its own shelves. A touch of parody gave its theme the comic relief of life.